So, brethren, we do thank the Heavenly Father for the privilege of sharing thoughts, and I'm sure all the brethren that serve do. And it's our sincere hope that what we speak glorifies Him and brings honor to His Son. This subject, Revelation chapter 17, is a challenge to go through in an hour's time. Basically be reading it with you on the screen here. I did put the notes in the chat earlier. I'd like to say that we've studied the entire Revelation because it's not very adequate to try to speak about a chapter or a portion of the Revelation without having studied it in its entirety. For there is integrated symbols that one wants to try to interpret as consistently as possible and reasonably. And we've tried to do that. And also, we'd like to say that one cannot understand the Revelation without first understanding the divine plan of the ages, which is mentioned repeatedly in the Revelation. But with that, I also like to say that the presentation here in this 17th chapter, we think, follows lessons that Brother Russell brought out in the six volumes, particularly the textbooks of his writings, his message, but also incorporates his concluding thoughts found in the October 1st, 1916 forewords that, in my mind, they are consistent. His earlier thoughts as contained in the volumes, as well as the 1916 foreword. We're going to consider part of the 1916 foreword to the fourth volume, further along here in the text. But I want to read just a little bit, and it's true, I'm hunting and pecking for a few phrases. But I'm in the 1916 foreword, fourth volume, page 2, bottom paragraph. Already the king's political and financial and their advisors are in great perplexity respecting what shall be done after the close of the war to prevent worldwide revolution and of the discontented. End of quote. Brother Russell wrote this October 1st, 1916. His flesh died in October 31st. His new creature graduated. America hadn't entered the war yet and wouldn't do so till 1917. And the war wouldn't end until November of 1918. So we ask ourselves, how come Brother Russell was writing in 1916, in the midst of the war, that these things would have to take place after the close of the war? Well, he goes on. Same foreword, page 3, top paragraph. The Bible points out that about this time, that is, after the close of the war in context, the nominal church systems of the world will rise to great prominence, again, in connection with the civil powers. Now, I'm just stop there. You notice that Brother Russell says the Bible is pointing out that there will be an alliance after the war between the nominal churches of the world in harmony with the civil powers. Now, the next paragraph on that same page 3. But the Bible declares that this reign as a queen will be a short one and that the fall of Babylon will be tremendous. A great millstone cast into the sea. End of quote. You notice he says once again, the Bible declares that this reign will be of the queen of the nominal church systems. One last quote, bottom of that same page 3. At the time of Babylon's fall, the mighty ones of the earth, financial and political, princes and kings will stand afar off, keeping clear of too close an affiliation with her, although they greatly lament her destruction, realizing that it forebodes their own. End of quote. So, brethren, we ask ourselves, what prophecies was Brother Russell looking at in the Bible that led him to believe with conviction that the war would end and there would be this future rise of a church and civil power agreement. Well, we think that's part of Revelation 17. It's also part of Revelation 15, 16, 18, and 19. Those prophecies from literally the 14th chapter through the 19th chapter help depict in the main what these lessons would be. And I think it was there that he was looking primarily for his statement that he made. The Bible points out and gave him conviction. So with that, what we're offering here today is suggestions. No, it's highly interpretive. And but we must begin. Revelation 17, 1 and 2. And there came one of the seven angels which had seven bowls and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. We were introduced to the seven angels with the seven bowls in chapters 15, verse 1 and 2, and chapter 16, verse 1. These are seven messages that the seven star messengers had already trumpeted during the stage of the seven churches. It is in these messages that there would be the seven last plugging hard messages of truth that the nominal systems would not be able to ignore. Remember, last plagues means that there have been previous plagues. That is, the messages of truth previously given throughout the gospel age had a plaguing effect, but the extent of the plaguing was limited, as it was not yet time for the complete destruction of churchianity, as shown in chapters 15 and 16. It is when the Lord provides the seven golden bowls that the means of delivering these last plagues will be manifest. In verse 1, we see one of these messages, and for several reasons we believe this is the seventh message, the harvest message of truth delivered by Brother Russell, starting about 1874 AD. It is his greatly detailed writings in the six volumes, especially volumes 2, 3, and 4, that clearly and scripturally demonstrate the great harlot as the papal system. The kings of the earth that had an illicit relationship with her are the various kings, emperors, and rulers from about 539 AD through 1914 AD. It was a time when various countries were known as Christendom, a very misleading title. There is another time evidence for when to start dating this chapter. It's in verse 10, Revelation 17:10. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is. And I put in, it's the sixth. And there is not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. We will list the seven kings further along, but for now we will state that this sixth king is Victor Emmanuel II, known as the king who unified Italy. It was during his reign that papacy lost the papal states gifted to them about 1,300 years earlier. He reigned from 1861 A.D. through 1878 A.D. So we can easily discern that from our time perspective of verse 1 and 2 is during this period from 1874 onward, when Brother Russell started to write his message, the harvest message. Again, it has been Brother Russell's writings that have shown us, the John class, scripturally and historically, that the time for the great harlot or Babylon the Great, verses 5 and 18, to be judged is 1878 AD. This is the time of her casting off, no longer being useful, no further attempts being made for her reformation or healing. She is judged down, and the Lord's spirit-begotten people are to come out of her, Revelation 18, 1 through 4. In fact, one of the main lessons of chapter 17 is the final destruction of Babylon the Great. Yet we are given the insights in this chapter to symbolically read of the long history of papacy, both as a religious and civil authority. Also in this chapter, we read of the woman or harlot. This is because we are being shown that predominantly the religious element of Roman Catholicism has been alive and active for the entire time since Emperor Constantine in 313 AD. Whether or not Roman Catholicism had been in control of the government, chapters 12 and 13 of the Revelation, we learned about her development and rise to power. Similarly, we read here of her long history, but we also read of her eventual demise. We read that she sits upon many waters. Sitting denotes being supported by the waters, many waters. The symbol of waters is provided in verse 15. The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. This demonstrates that as a religious system, papacy is supported by many different people from many different countries and languages. In fact, we might think of the papacy or Roman Catholicism as being supported by many people from all around the world. When she sits upon many waters, it is evident that she's not sitting upon the beast. I'll repeat. When she sits upon the many waters, she's not sitting upon the beast, as in verses 3 and 7. The beast is a union of church and state cooperating together to rule over the people. The people are shown as the body of the Roman beast. So then, when there is a religious and civil government in power, like the Holy Roman Empire period, the harlot papacy sits upon or is supported by the beast, a church and state government. When the form of government is not a church and state government, then the harlot is shown as sitting on the waters, the Roman Catholic people. The harlot being an unchaste woman represents the religious aspect of papacy, while the civil part of papacy is shown as being part of the beastly government, the bestower of crowns. Being drunk with the wine of her fornication shows that her false doctrinal teachings had a powerful effect. Yes, it is very intoxicating or heady to think that mere human rulers, along with popes, cardinals, bishops, and other clergy members, might have the right to rule in the name of God Almighty and Jesus Christ. We read of the inhabitants of earth, the common people who are restrained by their religious beliefs, into being supportive of such an incredible form of government. Who could resist such an overwhelming system of control? People were ordered and trained to believe and live and pay taxes and by all means support this oppressive cultural and economic juggernaut. The church controlled their eternal life and destiny while the state controlled their current life affairs. Verses 3 through 6. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet colored beast, full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of saints and with the blood of martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great astonishment. In these verses, the John class is taken back in time for a historical look at the time period in which the papacy was the leading influence. It was Brother Russell's writings that have shown us that the wilderness period was the 1260 years of papal hierarchy from 539 AD to 1799 AD, depicted in Revelation, the 12th chapter, verses 6 and 14. The purer element of the church was outside of the city, Babylon, either in spirit or literally. The harlot ruled the sinful church and state government of the so-called Holy Roman Empire that began in 808 AD with the Pope crowning Charlemagne and lasted until 1799 when Pope Pius VI died in prison, a long 1,000 years of strong papal influence upon the governments of Christendom. We note that it requires that one is outside of the present nominal church systems to understand how the Lord views these events. The seven-headed, ten-horned beast is the same that we read of in Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. That was the papal beast, combination of a religious system that has a civil authority as the head. With the papacy, it is the line of popes that is considered to be Christ's vicar, as well as a civil authority over earth. The expression seven heads and ten horns is a means by which we can identify that we are considering the Roman Empire during one of its seven heads. We will consider the heads and horns in detail further along in this chapter. But for now, let us say that a head symbolizes a form of government, and seven heads represent seven successive forms of government. The ten horns represent complete earthly powers, or lesser kings or civil authorities, similar to the ten toes in Daniel, the second chapter, the metallic image. It is possible to have multiple horns at the same time, and there might be more or less than ten at any given time in history. Since the horns of an animal are always on the head, it demonstrates that these lesser powers are used to support the current head or overarching controlling government. For example, the various kings and princes of Europe were to support the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, then the current head. Names of blasphemy, both in here in 17th chapter verse 3 and back in the 13th chapter verse 5. It's during the fourth head, the so-called Holy Roman Empire period, that the church and state form of government claim to rule in Christ's name or by his authority. And since they think that Jesus is God, they believe that they are God's kingdom on earth. What blasphemy! The woman we were shown clothed in purple and scarlet represents papacy's claim to kingly or royal authority. Clad with gold and precious jewels and pearls also suggests her claims of divine and spiritual wealth, like a counterfeit of the New Jerusalem depicted in such ways, chapter 21, verses 18 to 21. However, it cannot be ignored that papacy also actually, physically, presented herself in as grand a way as possible. Think of all the pomp and ceremony and pageantry, the elaborate clothes and gold crucifixes, the soaring cathedrals, fabulous artwork from paintings to sculptures to furnishings, stained glass windows, incense, glorious music and choirs, expansive grounds, all meant to present the papacy as God's kingdom of God, of Christ on earth. She had a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. As indicated in verse 2, it is wine, representing false doctrines. Golden represents divine, so papacy had the word of God, but filled its pages with erroneous teachings. Her abominations include transubstantiation, trinity, hellfire, immortality of the human soul, mariolatry, indulgences, clergy, laity, prayers for the dead, candles and incense, genuflexing before statues, man-made ordination, priests forbidden to marry, worship of saints, confessions, and the leading deceptive teaching is that her illicit relationship with the kings of earth. We read likewise in Jeremiah 51, verse 7, Babylon was a gold cup in the Lord's hand. She made the whole earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, therefore they have now gone mad. During the Dark Ages, the papist monk Copias kept the Bible, even though in Latin, available for those who were pious and made the effort to take what truth they could from Scripture. Like Elijah snatching precious pieces of meat from the ravens as he was by the brook, so too the saintly throughout the age have been fed while in the wilderness condition. But since the Great Reformation, and even more so, since 1803 AD, the Lord has brought forth Bibles abundantly. Upon her forehead a name written, again the forehead representing a mental agreement, as well as being very prominent before the people, like a counterfeit of the high priest's mitre. Mystery. This demonstrates that even though something's very prominent, it does not mean that everyone understands it. This mystery reminds us of 2 Thessalonians 2, 3 through 8, where Paul writes of the mystery of iniquity, the man of sin, which is the line of popes, assuming the authority of Jesus Christ before the world. Babylon the Great. We have learned that Babylon can be interpreted as either confusion or the gateway to God. There was literal Babylon that enslaved the Israelites until God delivered them. And here it is, mystic Babylon, that enslaved spiritual Israelites until God delivered them. In part in the past, but even more completely now, since 1878 AD, come out of her, my people, Revelation 18:4. Her doctrines have so confused or made drunk the nations that relatively few truly recognize her awful condition as a usurper of God's and Jesus' rightful positions. She claims to be the only way to heaven. As if this wasn't bad enough, we read that she has committed spiritual harlotry, but she is also a mother of harlots. Wow. Other Christian denominations have followed her example. They, too, gave up waiting for the bridegroom to return. Rather, they engaged in relationship with the kings and mighty ones of earth, having the same doctrine of representing God's kingdom on earth. Many of the various Protestant denominations that have gotten themselves more or less involved with the civil authorities, including politics, are in fact going about trying to set up Christ's kingdom or government before he returns. We can look back to the Great Reformation and recognize the beginning of this great confusion. Consider reprint 3984 on Reformed churches becoming state churches. Furthermore, they also adopted many of the worst abominations of doctrinal teachings that the mother harlot has. The woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. What a horrific scene. Brother Russell, in the second volume study on the man of sin, gives pages of historical examples of papacy's slaughter and torture of any who did not conform to her teachings or recognize her authority. By these great inquisitions and relentless persecutions of millions during this dark age period, including some of the Lord's true saints, her drunkenness implies that such horrific power went to her head, seemingly to increase her grip over the majority of people. In fact, in Revelation 18:24, we read, "In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that was slain upon the earth." Looking back in history to the time frame of the church's experiences of the 1260 years in the wilderness, this scene ends with the John class in great astonishment at such brutality and power that this harlot woman, the Antichrist religious system, had that dominated the Christian world for over 1,000 years. Verses 7 and 8. "And the angel said unto me, Wherefore did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carried her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into destruction. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is." I want to interject a thought here. I don't think we're to literally expect Brother Russell to be talking to us from the spirit realm, where I believe he is, as one of the saints. But I think his writings still speak to us as if they're like almost living writings, because he wrote in such a way of the times we're living in and what is yet before us that we can truly appreciate them as if they're speaking to us. With verse 7, we return back to the time frame of verse 1. That is, back to the time of the sixth head. We're no longer in that wilderness condition period. Now we're brought back to the time of the sixth head, from about 1870 AD onward, but especially after 1874, when Brother Russell was writing the Harvest Message. The Harvest Message asks the question, so to speak, in order to prepare our minds for the answer to be given. Brother Russell himself does not literally talk to anyone on earth since his death and graduation. His writing is what speaks to us. The Harvest Message reveals to the John class the historic mystery of the counterfeit Antichrist system that had wielded so much power for so long. The woman papacy with the 7-headed, 10-horned beast, church and state government, ruled over the empire. This was during that previous historic time frame of the so-called Holy Roman Empire, or the counterfeit millennium, 800 AD to 1799. Note, this was a time in which the beast was carrying the harlot, supporting her. This was during the fourth head. The beast that you saw was, yes, this church-state government was the fourth head, 800 AD to 1799, and is not the same church-state form of government was ended in 1799 by Napoleon's imprisonment of the Pope and a subsequent death in prison. This began the fifth head, the Napoleonic government, including his descendants, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into destruction. This fourth head form of government, church and state, that ceased in 1799, is described as going into the bottomless pit, only to ascend at some future point in time, and then it shall be destroyed. This means that the church and state form of government ceased to be, but it will make a comeback. It shall return at some future point in time, and when it does, it will act to a large extent like it did during its previous time in power. This will be the eighth, a repeat head, a repeat form of government. Now we will quote verses 11 through 13. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and I put in the word heads, and goes into destruction. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Now, we jumped ahead to verses 11 to 13. We got to backtrack. But we wanted to see, here's where this beast that was and is not, he does appear, reappear. But we will consider these verses further along. This fourth head, a church state form of government, makes a surprising comeback to power for a very short period of time before this form of government is destroyed, never to reappear. Verses, chapter 17, verse 8. Now we're going back in context. Verse 8. They that dwell on the earth shall wonder when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. Earlier in verse 2, we read of those who are of the earth class. These are Christians under religious restraint. But here it demonstrates that these same people are in wonderment that that old church state form of government can reoccur as an eighth head. How unlikely it seems until it happens. And when it does, we read that these, they that dwell on the earth, will not be part of the overcoming true church. For we read further in verse 8, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. This book of life is referring to those who will be found faithful to be part of the predestined class of 144,000 who have achieved the image of Christ's likeness. Verses 9 through 11. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen and one is. The other's not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goes into destruction. This is referring to the new creature mind. This is the mind that receives the wisdom that comes from above. The following symbolic explanation requires some thoughtful consideration. It's not meant to be readily understood. The seven heads are part of the beast as well as part of the great red dragon found in Revelation chapter 12, verse 3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns, seven crowns upon his heads. These are seven successive forms of government over the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is not always depicted as a beast, church and state, nor is it always shown as a dragon, mostly, if not completely, civil power. These seven heads, forms of government, are seven mountains. Mountains symbolize kingdoms or governments. These seven successive forms of government or kingdoms of the Roman Empire are those on which the woman sits. The woman is the harlot papacy as an unfaithful church system. On one hand, the seven mountains or hills upon which papacy sat was considered by many to represent the seven actual hills of Rome, and I've listed the seven names. However, there seems to be more to these symbols. The use of the word sits must be understood in an accommodated sense. Why? Because the same woman papacy was shown to us as sitting upon the waters during the sixth head, not on the beast. This we read in verse 1, and it also is stated in verse 10. What does it mean that she sits on the waters at the time of the sixth head instead of being on the beast? As we will consider in more detail following, it means that the papacy was in existence and had some little influence, at least during Victor Emmanuel II's government, the sixth head, even though she was not riding or sitting on the beast. This is because his government was not a church and state form of government. Rather, she was sitting on the waters being supported by the people, primarily as a religious system. Those were Roman Catholics. Further, in Revelation 12, considering that great red dragon, it had the same seven heads and ten horns, styled as symbols of the Roman Empire, and starting with Constantine the Great, who was the first emperor to convert to nominal Christianity in 312 AD. It was shortly after this that the man-child, the line of popes in their infancy or development, came into competition with the emperors as to who would have control of the empire. So then the expression, the woman sits upon the seven mountains, represents that we are to start counting the seven heads as beginning with Constantine and the Roman Christian era. The sitting denotes that the papacy had some influence with each of the successive heads, although at times it was very limited, and rather more as a religion than much else. This lesson is very helpful for us to understand when we should start to count the seven heads or successive forms of government of the empire. For we know that historically Rome had already been a great empire before and during the beginning of the Christian era. However, the harlot papacy, her history began during Constantine the Great's reign. Note that in harmony with the foregoing, it was one of the heads, forms of government, of the seven-headed ten-horned beast, church-state form of government, that went into the bottomless pit. Not the woman, not papacy as a religious system. And there are seven kings, mountains or heads. Five are fallen, that's past. One is, currently the sixth. One has not yet come, future. And when he comes, the seventh head or mountain king, he must continue a short space, reign for a short time in comparison to the other six heads. Seven heads lists. The first, Constantine the Great in Western Empire, starting in 313 AD through 476. Second, the Goths, includes the various different tribes that came to power, 476 AD to 527. Third, Justinian the First, 527 AD to 800. Four, Charlemagne, Papal Roman Empire, the counterfeit millennium, 800 to 1799, the start of papacy ruling with a civil authority and power, the start of the Holy Roman Empire. Five, Napoleon and descendants, 1799 to 1870. Note the counterfeit papal millennium ended in 1799. Six, Victor Emmanuel II and descendants, 1870 to 1925. That closing date's accommodated as this is the date recognized for Mussolini and the fascist powers over Italy. Number seven, fascist Nazi regimes, 1925 to 1945, a short period. And eight, a repeat of the fourth head, church and state form of government, the beast coming out of the bottomless pit. Even he is the eighth and is of the seventh, still future. A hidden time because of the connection to the completion of the 144,000. Verses 12 through 14. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings which have received no kingdom, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with them are called and chosen and faithful. Unlike the seven heads, the ten horns can be concurrent with each other rather than successive. These horns or kings are each less powerful than the one head or king. These ten horns are lesser kings or countries that lend their power to assist the one head or king. Throughout the Christian era, there might have been less than actual ten horns, lesser kings at the same time. In other words, there did not always need to be ten kings all at the same time. Rather, this is a number that at times could have been literally ten, but more importantly, it's symbolic of complete. Like to the ten toes of the Gentile times metallic image that Daniel saw, once again, it is assuring us that we are to think of this as an identifier of the Roman Empire. It is a very important point to observe right now, when we refer to the Roman Empire, we include some of the former colonies to which some European nations had extended their power, for example, the Americas. These 10 kings have no power as kings yet. It is possible that these are post-1914 kings or powers. In comparison to the pre-1914 kings, they do not claim the divine right to rule. Rather, monarchies gave place to democracies, republics, socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, and so on. There will be a time in the future when the eighth head, a church-state government, will come back into existence. The fourth head of the seven-headed, ten-horned beast will ascend out of the bottomless pit, and for a short time, an hour, will receive cooperative power from the 10 lesser powers to unite together one last time. We will read from the second volume, page 263. Second volume, 263, quote, "It would not be surprising if a strong government, a monarchy, would someday replace this present great republic. And it is entirely probable that one common standard of religious belief will be deemed expedient and will be promulgated to teach outside of which will be treated and punished as a political offense. Such a persecution would not only furnish in the end or harvest of this age another parallel to the harvest of the Jewish age, but also give a wider and deeper significance to the words of the apostles Paul and John found in 2 Timothy 4:3, Revelation 13:17, and to the typical illustrations of the close of the earthly career of the true church as represented in Elijah's whirlwind departure and John the Baptist's imprisonment and beheading." End of quote. This scenario is what Brother Russell was expecting in the six volumes, the reprints, and in that 1916 forward where we read. Particularly pertinent is the fourth volume, page 19. The 1916 forward, pages 2 through 4 in part, and here we'll read it together what I read at the beginning. Fourth volume, 1916 forward, page 2, paragraph 3 in part, quote, "Already the kings, political and financial, and their advisors are in great perplexity respecting what shall be done after the close of the war to prevent worldwide revolution of the discontented." End of quote. Page 3, paragraph 1 in part, quote, "The Bible points out that about this time," and I'm putting in here, after the close of the war in the preceding paragraph, "the nominal church systems of the world will rise to great prominence again in connection with the civil powers. We can readily see the grounds for this. All the kingdoms financially weakened will realize the necessity for keeping a dominating grip upon the public and preventing anything akin to socialism and anarchy. They will naturally look to the great religious institution called the churches to support them." End of that quote. Further on, same page, quote, "But the Bible declares that this reign as a queen," and I'm inserting Revelation 18:7. That's not Brother Russell. I'm inserting that. "Will be a short one, and that the fall of Babylon will be tremendous, like a great millstone cast into the sea. It will be during the power of this so-called queen, for a little season, that the world will be under a great strain as respects any presentation of the truth. And those found loyal to God and to principles will doubtless suffer therefore." End of verse. I'm repeating from the beginning. Brother Russell went to his reward October 31st, 1916. America did not enter the war until April 6, 1917. And the Great War did not end until November 11th, 1918. Yet Brother Russell wrote in 1916 that he believed that the Bible taught in some prophecies that there would need to be the scenario he wrote out foregoing. Regardless of what it looked like at the time, it would have to take place after the war was over. What scriptures was he looking at? My best guess is Revelation chapters 14 through 19. Now returning to Revelation 17. We're given a remarkable insight in verse 17. "For God incline their hearts to do his purpose, even to execute one purpose, and to give their kingdom to the beast till the words of God shall be completed." The diaglot wonder. As in a number of Old Testament examples, think of Gog in Ezekiel 38, 1 and 3, with the hardening of Pharaoh's heart in Exodus 7, verse 3, we read that it is God's purpose for this future rise to power of a church and state form of government, even though it will make war, persecute, the final feet members of the body of the Christ. This is informing us that God is setting the stage, so to speak, for the final destruction of the Antichrist systems. It will be his great retributive judgment, especially upon the harlot systems of churchianity. Now returning in Revelation 17 to verse 14, picking up the context again. The Lamb is Jesus Christ. His power and authority were second only to Almighty himself, for God planned it so. And those that are with him are his bride, the 144,000. They are described as being called. That is, each previously responded to the high calling of the divine nature. These were then chosen. Many have been called during this long gospel age, but of those called, fewer were actually chosen to be spirit-begotten. And of those who were spirit-begotten, only 144,000, a little flock, have been completely faithful, even unto death. Again, do we read verse 14? These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. This verse implies there will be a final persecution upon Christ's body members who remain in the flesh in order to give the final witness, much like the antitypical John the Baptist. Please see the second volume, pages 260 through 264. The only way this earthly power of church and state can make war with the Lamb is by making war upon his body members still in the flesh. This is similar to what Jesus told Saul when he appeared to him on the road to Damascus. See Acts chapter 9, verses 1 through 6. These faithful will resist receiving the mark of the beast and his image, as shown in chapters 13 and 15 and chapter 20. Of Jesus and the saints' great victory, we read in more detail in chapter 19, verses 11 through 21. But we want to note, we especially read in Revelation 19, 16, that he hath on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This very name stated in Revelation 17, 14. This helps cement our time frame. In Revelation 17, picking up in verses 15 through 17. And he said unto me, the waters which you saw, where the harlot sits, are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns which you saw upon, and the beast, is a better in the Greek, the ten horns which you saw and the beast, these shall hate the harlot, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. As was noted in back in verse 1, the harlot papacy, the religious part emphasized, has always been supported by the people, those who are Roman Catholic, whether or not papacy was an active role in a church-state government. Then she was shown as sitting on the beast. We then read that apparently this 1 hour of power with the ten horns comes to a violent end. That's depicted in Revelation 18, 21, and 19, 20. These ten lesser kings, civil powers, awaken out of their drunken condition, turning their ire especially against the religious part of papacy. We also read that the beast likewise hates the harlot. Instead of carrying or supporting the religious element of papacy any longer, the state part rejects any partnership with the ecclesiastical part. Furthermore, the body of the beast, the people of the Roman Empire countries, turn against papacy both in its religious and civil aspects. They, the civil authorities, and the people shall hate the harlot. Yes, after all of papacy's false doctrines and false practices have been fully exposed to the people through the final witnessing of truth by the Elijah and John the Baptist antitypes, the feet members of the church, vengeance will be theirs. They shall make her desolate, That is, they will no longer support her on the beast or on the waters. In fact, Babylon shall be cast down with violence, like a great millstone, into the sea, which are waters. The sea represents people without religious restraint. This is found in Revelation 18:21. They shall make her naked. Again, the people will no longer be under her spell of delusions. All of her former riches and glory of apparel is stripped away, showing her devoid of any claims to royalty or celestial beauty. They shall eat her flesh. How grotesque a vision. It brings to mind how wicked Jezebel met her end. After being trodden under the hoofs of the horses, she was eaten by the dogs, who left only her skull, the palms of her hands and feet. Found in 2 Kings 9. In this account, it is horses, doctrinal truths, that led to the destruction of papacy. Then the dogs eat her flesh. The dogs represent those who were formerly the bundled tares, nominally Christian. Now they have been burned as such, and instead they are indignant masses who execute such destruction upon papacy, and for that matter, the harlot daughters of Protestantism, that all that is left will be burned with fire. Yes, the end will be complete anarchy. This last expression, and burn her with fire, finds a long list of verses in Revelation 18. Her burning as a city and the smoke thereof are witnessed by all who had any relationship to these antichrist systems during this eighth and last head of the beast. As stated earlier, it is God's will that there be first a grand exaltation and then a sudden and violent destruction of great Babylon, the city that deceived the nations. After all the blasphemies, the lies and deceptions and persecutions, all done in his name and in the name of his holy son, he will make it plain that all of this really was of Satan and his minions. Verse 18, and the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. And so our chapter closes as it opened. The woman, the harlot, is symbolic of mystic Babylon, particularly the religious aspect. A city or government that had at times successfully instructed the civil authorities who were of the earth, those who were under religious beliefs or restraint. This sets the stage for the next chapter, chapter 18, which describes her sins in God's just retribution. So here is the end of the 18th chapter. We make a few, the end of the 17th chapter. I'm sorry, I just looked at my notes. The end of the 17th chapter. This is a peculiar chapter where we have a harlot woman shown separately from the beast, and yet we see an interaction. We note that we're shown the long dark age history of papacy, and yet we're shown it from a perspective of looking back in time, from the day of Brother Russell's writings, so that we could be assured that we would have the harvest message perspective on what to expect. The thought of a headless beast, the eighth being a headless beast, it's hard for me to grasp. I know Brother Russell has a statement that way early on, doesn't elaborate on it much. It doesn't say the eighth is a headless beast. But to me, the struggle is that a beast has a body, the people of the empire, has a head, the form of government controlling that empire at a time, and the heads would be the horns would be on the heads. So these are lesser powers that are supporting the one form of government. If there was no head, a headless beast, where would you have the horns? And if you have a headless beast, to my mind, that's a decapitated beast. I don't know how a beast lives without a head. So when it says the eighth is of the seven, it's, to my mind, it's a way of just stating that it's a repeat former head that had gone into a bottomless pit, but would reappear for a short time and then be utterly destroyed. So I know there's fine brethren who have various views, and let each of us, of course, be convinced in our own mind on how it all might fit together. But from this perspective, and I think Brother Russell was looking for a future role for the final feet members of the church to give a witness. And we will now take the time that we have left, I'm pleasantly surprised, to scroll down a little bit further past the 17th chapter. I've included a few more notes. We have this expression in verse Revelation 17, verse 12, that these 10 horns are 10 kings. They had no power as yet, but they received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. They have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For his Lord of lords and King of kings, they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So that hour pricks our attention. In Luke 22, verse 53, when I, Jesus, was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. Jesus is stating that he understood that the short period of time from when the forces of darkness, guided by the wicked influence of Satan, had commenced, he would have to confront the Jewish religious leaders and then the civil authorities before which he would give his final witness. We make note, brethren, that it was two religious camps that cooperated to persecute Jesus, the Sadducees and the Pharisees together as part of the Sanhedrin. Reminds us of like the papacy and the Protestants cooperating, taking them to a reluctant civil ruler. In Daniel 3, verse 15, it was the great image set up in the plain of Dura. We read verse 15. Now, if you be ready to fall down and worship the image which I have made, it is well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. This is the trial of the three Hebrews, which did not worship the metallic image. This might represent the future trial of worshiping the vitalized image of Federated Protestantism. Please consider reprint 2495 and 2496 on that lesson. And then in Daniel 5, verses 1 through 5 and in verse 30, this chapter shows the very night in which King Belshazzar held a great feast and defiled the drinking vessels from the temple of Jehovah. And we read, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hands and wrote. That's Daniel 5:5 in part. The aged Daniel was called to interpret the writing. There was a judgment verdict from God. That very night Babylon fell to the Medes and Persians. Daniel may well symbolize the final feet members of Christ giving a final witness before kings and leaders in powerful positions. And lastly, Matthew 10, verses 18 through 20. Matthew 10, 18, 20. Jesus said, "And you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak. It shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaks in you." What a wonderful consolation. If we have developed the proper character and have faithfully studied the Word of God, and if it be part of His plans, He will provide us with the words to speak on His authority. May the Lord add His blessing and overrule anything we might have said amiss.